Okay, this is Mitch Fincher, and I'm with Temple Tucker on March 28th, 2019. And we're going to talk about his growing up and his relation to the ranch out there and the things he learned and the stories he has.
Well, I'm impressed that Mitch wanted to do this, and I was too lazy to try to type up or print something of this nature about primarily the ranch, but I love it. I remember we had these sessions with Granddad P.S. Fincher on his front porch in Albany is what I remember mainly when I was growing up. Mitch's dad and Mitch's granddad ran the ranch at the time they lived there, and Granddad lived on the farm in Albany, and after supper at night, when we were visiting, we would always go out on the front porch. He'd fire up his pipe, and he would start his stories with, well, back when I was much of a man, and he would start a story. And boy, were they interesting stories. And we tried to record them. The technology at that time was a wire, spool-to-spool recorder. And nobody can find the thing. We tried to do that one time, and we can't find it. So with cell phone voice recordings, that's what we're doing here, and I'm glad he likes it, and I like it. I've got my cell phone on also. I don't know what I'll do with it, but maybe my kids would like to have it also. Mm-hmm. But I want to start to make sure I don't miss it, that my memory of Granddad Pickin' Steel Fincher, Nita, my wife loves that name. She said if we had had children together before we got married, their name would, one of them would be named Steel. She thinks that's such a strong, wonderful name. But I want to comment on Granddad Fincher, my Granddad Fincher. I don't know, what's it, your great-great-granddad or whoever he was. The appreciation that I have of what God did for me and my family, that he allowed me to be in Granddad Fincher's family. Granddad Fincher was a strong Christian person. He was a strong supporter and member of the Presbyterian Church there in Albany, and we attended many services there. One of them, the Easter message, minister had just finished talking about before the cock crows the third time.
Yeah.
And I was sitting by an open window on the left side of that Presbyterian church, and a rooster crowed three times right outside that window. I will never forget that. But I grew up in a Christian tradition because of Granddad Fincher. And Mitch did not seem to know this, but I know in my immediate family of 14 people that went to Austin College, a Presbyterian college in Sherman, Texas. And I didn't finish this story, Mitch. This will be new to you. I was visiting with a Rice professor just by accident over lunch one day out on the Rice campus after I graduated. He wasn't a professor. He was an administrator. And somehow or another, I brought up how proud I was of Austin College and the people in my family that went to Austin College, and that it's really an outstanding school. And he said, oh, I know all about Austin College. They're just as strong as Rice is. They're not that well known. They are an extraordinarily good university. And I've always taken pride in that because of a Rice guy saying that, and they're pretty proud of themselves. And he put it on a par with Rice. The Rice was just different a little bit. He sent all five of his kids. I don't know if they all graduated, but all five of his kids went to Austin College. Mm-hmm. Adele Tucker is my mother, and Adele Fincher Tucker. And she went to Austin College. She married my dad, Charles F. Tucker, Charles A. Tucker, C-A-T. He went to Austin College. My sister, Dorothy, went to Austin College. My brother went to A&I. He did not go there. Dorothy's two children went to Austin College. And anyway, I get 14 just doing that. And recently I realized there's some other, you throw Roth Rocks into that mess. I bet we can find 20 or 25 people that went to Austin College because of Pickens, Steele, Fincher. And the only ones I know that went to Austin College are strong Christian people. I don't know if they went there because they were strong Christian people or the influence of the school or the influence of Granddad P.S. Fincher. But I just want to acknowledge that he is the soul of this family as far as I'm concerned. And one of the things that... I guess I'll just start telling some P.S. Fincher stories. One of them that happened in this same den in the Albany farmhouse, they had done all the farming things. Anybody that does not know how to make clabber or does not know how to make whey or cottage cheese or butter or whipping cream, I can tell you exactly how to do that. And when my son Brian heard me telling that to a Rothrock one time, one of the few times I ever saw a Rothrock, Brian could not wait to go get some whipping cream and go make some of those things. And I won't spend time here, but people normally are fascinated by knowing how to do a lot of stuff with milk. And we had done that. They had made butter and ice cream and all these things. And so after supper, they came in and asked Granddad if he wanted some ice cream. He said, no, I've got my pipe. He always had a pipe after supper. And I'll get it later. And so he said, well, we'll just put some in the icebox. I forget what they call. I think they called it a Frigidaire. That was a brand. Uh-huh. But it was a, you know, an automated thing. It wasn't a, put a block of ice in there like Dad's dad had. He had a true icebox. But after he finished his pipe, he comes walking in and said, don't y'all wish y'all had waited? And he had this big saucer just mounded up with what looked like to him ice cream. That was what they had saved for him, he thought. But he hadn't taken a bite yet. It's a shame we didn't wait. He said, no, Granddad, that's butter. That's the butter we made today. It was whipped up into a mound that looked like ice cream. It wasn't, you know, in these little cubes that you buy at the store.
So it was white? It wasn't white.
Okay. It was kind of creamy colored, and the ice cream was kind of creamy colored. I mean, you didn't have to. It wasn't hard to visualize mistaking that big plate full of butter. I thought that was fun. But that was an important room because every time we ever spent the night in that house, the whole family, whoever was there, normally Aunt Lurline and, Aunt Holmes. I'm sorry, I'm getting stage fright here, I guess. I've forgotten my sister, my only aunt. But she was normally there, but we always gathered in that family room, and they had an air cooler. It was just a big box that sat outside the window with wire and straw on five sides and a drip pan, and the fan sucked air through that straw, which had water dripping in it, and in a low humidity, got plenty cool, thank you very much. We didn't need modern air conditioning in that West Texas air. But every night we were there, we gathered in that room, and I was about to fall asleep because I was just a little kid. And so I'd be sitting on my cot, which was always right under that naked light fixture upstairs, I mean up on the ceiling. And by the time it was permissible for me to go to sleep after the devotional service, my bed was working alive with flies and bugs and things that were gathered around that light that had fallen on my bed. I don't remember that, but that was not a bad memory at all. And I did have trouble staying awake, but we always had Bible reading time, and it was just a devotional time for the family.
And Pickens Steele led that?
They probably deferred to my dad because he was the preacher.
Okay.
But this happened in his house. These are things that happened around Pickens Steel Fincher. He gathered Christian people around him. He warned his two girls, Aunt Nona and Adele, my mother, to not marry preachers because they couldn't afford to support a wife. Uh-huh. Well, they both did. And I don't feel like I missed a thing financially, and I'm very grateful, even though Granddad tried to make sure his girls didn't marry preacher. Both of them married preachers. But that is the beginning of my memory of Pickens Steel Fincher. And some of the stories that he told out on the front porch after supper before the night devotional, they were so interesting. One of them, you know, the word Indian means so many different things to different people. Americans have done terrible things to Indians, and we've done a lot for Indians. But he told about when he was too young to be a cowboy, he was kind of the cook for this ranch somewhere. Mm-hmm. Long before he bought his own ranch, I'm sure he was just a kid, kind of like I was a kid. Oh, he's probably 10, 15, probably yeah. 15 years old. And he was setting out the tables for all these cowhands that were doing like they did at Granddad Fincher's farm, ranch. All the ranchers gathered together and they helped each other. If it was bringing in the wheat crop, if it was going out and rounding up all the cattle and branding the ones that belonged to who, because along the river there were no fences. And but there were anyway, he was getting the meal ready for all these cowboys on this ranch. It was not his. And he looked out the window, and there was a bunch of Indians showed up, and they were in war paint and weapons. I mean, bows and arrows and hatchets and stuff. And this was extremely disconcerting to him, and because back before 1900, there were still a lot of problems between whites and Indians. And I'll tell you one about the ranch, as a matter of fact, but this was not his ranch. But he climbed up in the rafters, just, you know, visible as day, but they never looked up. They came in and grabbed a bunch of food off of the table and ate some stuff and left. And he was up in the rafters of this room where he was going to feed the cowboys later. Now, that's a cowboy and Indian story that's not normal, and Granddad experienced this. And Aunt Nona Showalter is the name of the other preacher in the family, besides my dad. She told me one time, just talking, that when Granddad died and they split up the ranch between the three boys, mm-hmm. that they had trouble with the surveying because on the back part of the ranch, because in 1900, the surveyors wouldn't go back on the back part of the ranch because of the Indians. Now, I don't know what that means. You can read the book Interwoven that Mitch has read and I've read with great glee. And there's nothing about scalping people and violence in there, but there's a lot about Indians, you know, what was going on mm-hmm. in the early 1900s. Granddad bought the ranch, I understand, in 1900. And, but Aunt Nona's comment, you know, things weren't totally peaceful if the surveyors wouldn't go yeah. back on the back part of the ranch because of the Indians, whatever that meant. So that's something that you don't run into today.
And, do you know what tribe the Indians were?
I know nothing about the Indians that were there. I'm sure that would be available to Interwoven. I recommend that to anybody interested in the Finchers. The reason I just was mesmerized by the book was because the Nail Ranch, no, not the Nail Ranch, that's even a bigger ranch. The Matthews Ranch, which was called Lamb's Head, mm-hmm. shared a fence with the Fincher Ranch. Now, Fincher Ranch was minuscule. Well, it looked like all of Hollywood to me. I mean, it was more acres than I could dream of. But the Matthews Ranch was much bigger than that. It's still a big ranch. But they shared a fence. So I figured that what Matthews' wife and his family, well, what Matthews did not marry, so I'm a generation behind in my storytelling here, because the woman that wrote Interwoven was not Watt Matthews' wife, because he never married, as far as I know. But anyway, the original owners of Matthews Ranch, she wrote that book telling of their experiences, just doing what Mitch was hoping I would do, and I'm too lazy to do. I do realize that to me, I have stories that just almost bring tears to my eyes because they're such significance to me, and I can understand how Mitch wants to preserve this. So what we're doing right now is an attempt to do that in a mm-hmm. in a cheap way, easy way. I'm not willing to do the hard part. But the fact that they shared a ranch tells me that just about the same things happened to the Matthews family that happened to the Fincher family. Mm-hmm. Now, that doesn't mean good, bad, or indifferent. It just meant the way they lived, the way they raised cattle, what they did. So I would encourage anybody interested in the Finchers to read Interwoven. Mitch has a copy. I have a copy. You cannot have my copy, but they're available. Those are some memories that about Granddad. Now, having said that, I told some of the stories I'm fixing to tell you to friends, and they were kind of shocked. They thought it was pretty cruel. And the two stories that they thought were cruel, other people have said those were different times in ranching. You couldn't be a horse whisperer and get your work done. They didn't know how to do that. But anyway, I was out with my slingshot throwing cans up by the chicken house in Granddad's farm chicken house backyard, and shooting them with a slingshot. And I was pretty proud that I could hit them pretty often. And so I was in front of beside the chicken yard by their trash pile. And Granddad was working one mule, Tobe or Rhody. They had two mules named Tobe and Rhody, two steel horses. They were buckskin colored with dark stripes down the back and a black tail, black mane. Big as the mules. I mean, these were big animals. Maybe they wouldn't look like the beer commercial. Maybe they weren't quite that big, but they were big animals. And I got to be involved with them, and I'm very proud of that. And I'm not proud, that's not the right word. I'm grateful that it did. But anyway, all of a sudden, Granddad was cussing. I never heard that before. He said some bad words. And he was yelling at Tobe or Rhody, only he was working on. He was plowing the garden. That's the way they lived. This was not casual entertainment for him. This was the way they lived. They had all kinds of fruit trees. They had all kinds of vegetables. They always had a bunch of canned vegetables down in the cellar, cement cellar. They were self-sustaining. Well, I guess they were. They could have been. They probably were emotionally self-sustaining, yeah, except for a few things. Well, anyway, I crept around and peeked around the chicken house. I didn't want Granddad to know that I saw him and heard him and saw him hitting the donkey with a 2x4 with some serious force.
Uh-huh.
And so I got out of sight real quick. I wasn't sure he was going to be happy that I saw that.
Hitting him in the head or the back?
Head. He was, pain was what we were working on here. Pain. The mule had done something wrong. I don't know what it was. And hopefully I remember to tell you a story about how well trained they were. But anyway, Granddad cussing and beating on a mule. So anyway, that was a shock. But I've told other people that story. And another one I'll tell you, and then I'll paraphrase it. One time, I guess, on the ranch, there weren't a whole lot of fences then, and there was a neighboring bull that kept showing up on our property, messing with our cows. And if you're trying to develop a strain of cattle, you want to choose the bull. And so this is a big deal. And so he lets him into the corral, and had a big hitching post, probably the equivalent of a railroad tie, buried in the ground. I mean, a stout post that you would tie whatever you needed to tie up to that hitching post. Well, he tied that bull to that hitching post and got some kind of a syringe, like it was a giant syringe. He didn't show it to me, but I picture it as probably being a foot long that probably held a pint to a quart of liquid. And while that bull was tied to that hitching post, he told me this story. He wasn't embarrassed about it. He was managing his ranch. He rammed this syringe. It wasn't a needle. It was, you know, something like you would give an enema with or something. I don't know what it was used for. It wasn't something you'd use on a human. But he injected a pint to a quart of turpentine into his rectum. And at first there was no reaction, and then he began to shudder like a train firing up, trembling, and then he went crazy. And he jerked that hitching post right out of the ground and hit it over the horizon, and he never saw him again. Now, he was effective. And so those are two pretty brutal stories. Animals was there to help. They weren't to sit in your lap and talk to and pet. They were to do a job. And he treated his... I saw him get pretty upset with a dog one time that was running away and going through fences, jumping fences, and was not doing a ranch dog's job, which included a lot of good stuff. This dog had not gotten with the program. So he tied a long, long, heavy chain to his collar. The idea being, it's pretty hard to get around, maybe impossible to climb a fence.
Yeah.
And I don't know what happened to that dog, but they always had a dog, and it was always a helpful one, except for that one. Don't know what happened to that dog. But I told these stories to friends one time, and because I knew they hadn't had those experiences. They grew up in the city. And they were horrified that that's so brutal. You know, that's brutal. That's brutal. Well, yeah. But I would add my phrase that I've seen movies and stories about horse whisperers, you know, that you don't get out there and ride them till they drop. You go talk to them and they decide to let you do what you want to do. And I'm sure that's more the deal nowadays. And not many people do what I told Granddad to do. But remember, we're talking about early 1900s, a guy that would starve to death if his ranch didn't produce.
Mm-hmm.
And a parallel story of my dad, who lived on a farm, not as big, but in Mulberry Canyon, in the Abilene area, mm-hmm. is where he grew up, on a farm, being self-sustaining. On Saturday, they would normally get in the wagon with his dad and a horse and ride to town and buy whatever they had to have that you can't raise on the farm. And one time his dad looked out in the pasture of the neighboring farm that was by the road, and he saw their garbage pile. Everybody had a garbage pile. They didn't have garbage trucks in those days. So everybody had a garbage pile. And so my granddad looked out into the garbage dump and just shook his head and with much feeling said, "They will never make it. They are spending money off of the farm." Now, that was probably a label off of a tin can of green beans, maybe. They could have, and in my granddad's view, should have, raised that and canned it themselves.
Yeah.
And sugar and sweets and all sorts of things. And, you know, to somebody that grew up in my era and Mitch's era, that's unheard of. We don't think about that. We just try not to spend more than we make at the store. But we were talking about self-sustaining. That's a whole, going to the store and buying something that you could make yourself, but you didn't. being something that would probably cause you to lose your farm someday. That's serious.
Yeah.
That's serious. That was real life. That's different. That's different than what Mitch and I have experienced. But I am so grateful for being in the Pincher family, and we will tell many more stories maybe before Mitch has to go home, but I just want to parallel this story with the fact that we're sitting now in what we call Gross Kinderhaus. That's what the Germans in this Fayette County area, a lot of Germans in this area, wonderful people, that's what they would call the grandchildren's house. So we're sitting in what for today is Mitch's room. And it's a nice looking room. Nita has let me decorate this. Now, that's unusual. She does not let me touch anything at home. She makes all the decisions at home, and there's not anything that that I do at home, and I'm happy with that. We have a very nicely decorated house. But she did pick out I chose the bed because we had a relative that had a trundle bed like that, and I thought, oh, that'll solve the problem of a little bitty room. Yeah. And a trundle bed will temporarily put an extra bed in. And she chose the colors for the blanket and all that, and the rest of it I did, though. But in this room is some artwork that my brother's wife, Jo, before she died, painted. Those are main features of the Presbyterian encampment at Choye. A lot of Presbyterians went to camp at Camp Choye up in central Texas. We went mainly to the area around Kerrville when I was growing up. But there's a lot of, to me, this whole place that we have added to protect it from encroachment by people that might do things that would keep it from looking like God's country that doesn't have a whole lot of people running around on it, just animals. The fact that this came about is really just God's handiwork. I've explained it to Mitch, but I'm not going to explain it here because some of it sounds a little self-serving, but God did a lot of wonderful things that enabled us to have this property now. And I am so grateful for that. And my specific thinking when I was a young parent, boy, as soon as I can, I sure hope I can own some land where my kids can go and go swimming and fishing mm-hmm. and hunting and throw rocks and yell and get dirty and not get in trouble. I mean, that's basically what I did out at the Albany Farm or the halfway place or the ranch at Fort Griffin. Mm-hmm. As a matter of fact, to commemorate the fact that Mitch is coming out here today, I showed him a sign I just had made that we're going to hang on the yard fence. His dad, Buddy Fincher, which was he and Randall and myself spent a lot of time together. Buddy did not look forward to that, he says, because my mother was such a strict disciplinarian that any time the Tuckers showed up, it was not going to be any fun whatsoever because my mother wouldn't let me do anything. but I remember Mitch's dad, Buddy, which he was older and stronger and a real rancher, and I was a city wimp, and I did work out there one summer. I don't know how much I helped, but I spent a lot of time there and loved it. But he old age had just set in. I forget where I was going with Buddy. And but he did real work. I mean, he used his summer job was Buddy's summer job was driving a shredder along the highways, probably paid good money, and he would come in from a day's time spent in the sunshine in Northwest Texas heat, and his lips were bleeding and chapped and cracked. It just was a picture of pain to look at it. And but that was his summer job, all day in the sun in West Texas. Does not make for soft, tender lips. But and Randall, he did real work. He did farm work when he was in his early teens. He was driving a tractor. And I was always jealous. They were real people, and I was just a city slicker. But I told Buddy one time, Mitch's dad, it's hard for me to think of, I'm talking to Buddy's son. We went out to get the one milk cow on the ranch to milk it. And on the way back, I was just euphoric. That is the only word. And I told Buddy, he said, I love doing this stuff. I love doing this stuff. And he turned on me with a little bit of anger, I think. You know, he was pretty, somebody might have called him a bully, but I loved it. I mean, I was a wimp and he wasn't, and that's okay with me. I fit in there somewhere. He loved me, I don't doubt about that, particularly in the later years, we really had a close relationship. But I told him how much I just loved what we were doing. He said, well, you wouldn't think it's so dadgum much fun if you lived here. And in the wintertime, you had to go get this cow and pull on those frozen tits. You wouldn't think it was all that much fun. And he wasn't joking. That was...
Make sure I'm still recording here. Yep.
So we're still recording for posterity here, it looks like.
Yep.
I don't know who's ever going to listen to this, but... that is a story of the difference between my life and Buddy's. And I'm sure, well, the summer I worked out there, I experienced some discomfort. They were raising melons, mm-hmm. watermelons, cantaloupes, and Buddy, he could do anything. He scavenged somewhere or another a Model A engine and hooked it up to a pump down by the river. They could pump water up from the river and irrigate this melon patch, which was a whole lower meadow, upper meadow between the first gate in front of the house mm-hmm. and the next gate where you just fall down a deep incline. That whole upper meadow, or half of it to the left at least, a lot of acres, probably 20 to 50 acres in melons. And so I would help them weed it. And so one, you know, being a weenie, I go out there barefooted one day and I come back and I didn't have the top layer of skin that I had enjoyed all of my prior life. That was all Johnson grass. I don't know if you're familiar with Johnson grass, but it's very abrasive. It's like sandpaper. And so I was dragging my feet as I picked it. I also walked through it. And I spent a pretty painful time. I went back to work the next day, but I was wearing a pair of tennis shoes, and I guess I had put something on there to try to help this stuff not get infected. But the top layer of skin was just gone. But another time we were gathering hay, maybe in the lower meadow, and not with a hay baler, but it was just a pitchfork and throwing it up on a wagon. And the Toba Rodeo, I'm sure, was there. And Uncle Theron promised us that when we got through with this very uncomfortable job, which was chaff going down your shirt. I mean, anybody that's done any kind of hay work knows that that can be uncomfortable. We'd go swimming in the river when we got through. Well, we never got through. We never got to go swimming. I missed that a lot. I'm sure he didn't remember that. We were doing important stuff. He meant if we have time, we will. But Buddy and I were both very disappointed. But anyway, Uncle Theron was so loving. Mitch's granddad, that's amazing. I just have, when I would go horseback, when I showed up at the ranch, they normally, quote, gave, end quote, me a horse. Mine was Stranger, great big horse that they claimed was the best cattle horse on the ranch in his day. He was pretty old at this time. Uh-huh. And I'll tell an embarrassing story in a minute, but...
the mic is right here.
Okay. Yeah. It was, they would just give me a horse. They would go out and adjust the stirrups for me. Since my feet were almost dragging the ground, even on this big, not really, but it was a big horse. So it was my size of a horse. But for me to be able to use this saddle safely, they had to let the stirrups out a bunch, which was easy to do. Well, not that easy, but they knew how to do it. But when I would go horseback riding by myself a lot, just a 22 and a horse and instructions not to shoot anything that looked like a cow, that was a lot of freedom.
Yeah.
And their story, and again, I'm telling some stories that will shock people, but it's not intended to belittle anybody, but when it was time for some meat, Uncle Theron was okay with shooting a deer because they ate his wheat patch. They lived off of his wheat patch. So why couldn't he take some meat once in a while? So he did not adhere to the game laws. Probably none of those ranchers around there did. And myself took that cue, and you could ride up to a dove on horseback, and the dove just wouldn't fly. So I would kill some dove sitting on a limb that hunters of today would be fairly offended if they knew that I'd done that. But I didn't think there's anything wrong with it. And at this point in life, my brother tells me that he thinks that Granddad decided to hold on to the white-faced cow, a British breed, too long. He just couldn't bring himself to sell off his herd and start from scratch.
Yeah.
And we're going to get some rain sooner or later. And he thinks that at that timing, he held them too long. And all the time I was growing up, they had this unbelievable movie set for me to go visit and have these loving people. But there wasn't much money floating around. The ranch house probably hadn't been painted in 50 years, I don't know. It looked wonderful to me. I mean, I'm sorry. When we test this, Temple's been putting his hand where it's not supposed to be. Hope it's audible. I'm going to test this. Oh, that turns it off. Anyway, when I put my hand here,
I think it's just coincidence.
Okay.
Yeah, that's good.
Okay. I'll try to keep away from that. Tell me when I don't. I can remember riding up, I don't know what part of the ranch it is, but I would call it the back of the ranch. It looked like something from a Roy Rogers movie. There was a lot of rocky, craggy, mountainous area. It wasn't where the cemetery is. It's way back somewhere in the ranch. Maybe Mitch will remember where that is. But were you alive before Granddad died? I guess not.
He died a year before I was born.
So you didn't experience any of him.
Mm-hmm.
How long before the ranch was sold? Pretty quick? I think it was sold pretty quick, wasn't it?
I think so. After
yeah. Died. Anyway, somewhere back on the ranch, it looked like a Roy Rogers scene, just big, huge stones and rocks and difficult to ride up on a horse. But after I discovered basketball and the coaches realized I was abnormally tall, I didn't get out there as much. I was busy. But I do remember one time I was out on horseback with my 22 way back down by the river. And I got off the horse, I think maybe to get a better shot at something, a dove. And the horse turned and stepped on my foot. I mean, the stranger was a large horse. That's probably 1,000 to 2,000 pounds. I don't know what a large horse weighs, but anyway, there was a loud pop. And I was just beside myself with grief. I figured my basketball career was over. I was sure that pop was the arch of my foot.
Ooh.
It hurt, but it wasn't just mind-curdlingly painful. But anyway, I got off and got the horse. No, I was already off. Caused the horse to move. Took his foot off of my foot. He didn't do it maliciously. He just was moving. And but anyway, it turned out to be nothing. It was a stick under my foot that snapped. So thank you, Lord, that that didn't do what I thought it was going to do. We may quit this in a minute. We've been doing it for 40 minutes. We're going to go eat and then come back and maybe do some more. But along the lines of animals, the barn in Albany with the big old brown, in other words, it didn't look like it had ever been painted either. That was the perfect color for me. I liked that. Same at the ranch. But the farm barn in Albany had a, I guess it's, I'm not sure this is what you call a tack room, but anyway, it's a little closet-looking thing. It's probably about half of this 10-foot-wide little bedroom that we're sitting in now, just enough room to bring in a large horse. And all along the sides and the back were all of the equipment to harness him up so he can pull a plow. And so you put him in there, shut the gate. He can't go anywhere. And I've experienced, I don't know what you call putting the harnesses on a horse. It's not calling saddled up. There's no saddle. But I am so grateful that I experienced that. I don't know if it was Randall and I or Buddy and I, but anyway, we were putting the equipment on a horse to enable him to pull a plow, which is the collar and the, I forget what you call that strong thing that goes around the collar and the main leather and chain things that fit back to the single tree. I have some that I bought in Round Top that I'm going to hook up the side straps, the chain and the leather, to a single tree, hang it to a rafter. I've got all that out there now, but people just think it's junk. But when I get it into using form, single tree hanging from one rafter, the two pull devices going down and hooking to the thing that goes around the collar. So anybody, a city slicker, could look at that and say, hey, that must be something that they use on a horse to allow him to pull a lot of weight. And but anyway, I was, this memory is, we were, I think it was Buddy, and we'd all been to the movie the last weekend. And if you ever find a movie, I haven't looked, maybe somebody that hears this will look. We saw a movie called Big Red. If you ever find that, I want it. Because while I was putting this stuff on this big mule, I was a tall person then, but his shoulders were as tall as I was. I mean, that was a big mule. Maybe not quite as tall as my head, but I'm 6'10". I'm sure those mules didn't have 6'10". They probably had over 6 foot shoulders. Anyway, this horse, this mule, Tobe or Rhody, leaned up against me, pinned me up against the wall. Now, normally that wouldn't have been a big deal, but since we had just seen Big Red, I was beside myself with terror, because the main character in Big Red is a red mule, and he does all the talking. It's his life as he sees it. And there was a very bad guy in the group, and he ended up killing the bad guy by pinning him up against a wall. That was a week before I saw that movie. Yeah. I thought I was fixing to die, but everybody that works animals, if you put a saddle on a horse, they don't like tight stuff around any more than you would. And a lot of them develop a habit of bloating up and take a deep breath and stay that way till you get through jacking around trying to tighten up the saddle cinch so it won't slip off. And then he'll let out his air, which he's a lot more comfortable. But the problem is you're probably going to fall off that horse, yeah, particularly if you try to do any cattle work. And I saw that happen at a Houston rodeo. To put a fact to it, we were watching the grand entry. We like to sit in the back of the stadium where behind where they loaded up the bulls for the bull riding and the grand parade. And everything's going on back there all the time. And when they were staging for the grand entry, there was this drugstore cowboy-looking guy that was bound to have been drunk. He was cussing and jerking his horse back and forth. The horse is doing nothing. But he was trying to look domineering. Really offended me. And I'm sure the horse didn't like it at all, but the horse just stood there and he was jerking. They left, and I developed a bad attitude about this horse owner already. when they came back in, that was the greatest part about that rodeo. He was walking. He was leading that same horse. And the saddle on that same horse was on the bottom. Now, we know what happened. The horse had bloated up. He thought he had a tight saddle cinch, but he didn't. And out there, somewhere on that arena in front of 50,000 people, that horse probably intentionally made a quick step, threw his weight a little bit to the side, or maybe he jerked him. Maybe the owner did the whole thing himself. Maybe he jerked him and caused the weight to shift, which caused the saddle to roll right around to the bottom and him on the ground. I love that story. But anyway, Randall and I particularly did a lot of plowing together. And maybe this one last story, and we'll go in and eat and come back.
And are these with tractors or horses?
This is going to be horses.
Okay, or mules.
They're still on the mules. There was like 20 acres that he raised crops on right by his farm in Albany, right across the street from the cemetery in Albany, which I think has one of the Doolittle, a famous war pilot from World War II.
Oh, yeah.
I think he's buried in that cemetery, along with my mother. And I think my daddy. Where's my daddy born? I forget. Anyway, we got the job of plowing that 20 acres. That's a square field, roughly, rectangle. And so we, you know, would strap up the mules. And I think we were only doing mules. We weren't doing the two horses. He had the capacity to do four big, which is a serious deal. We just had the mules. They had blinders on. We rigged up this sled. One of us rode the plow, and one of us rode the sled. Well, a guy riding a sled gets a lot of dirt. Breathe a lot of dirt following the plow by about 6 feet.
And the sled is just smooth out?
It's just a piece of wood that we hammered together and connected to the back of the plow. It'd be like a door, half of a door.
Uh-huh. And was that to smooth out the clods, or is that just for fun?
That was for the second guy to be able to go along and be together, so we could do it together.
Okay.
It had no function, probably was pretty dadgum dangerous, but it was a way for one of us to ride on the sled instead of having to just stay back by himself at the farm while Randall did the, well, it was for me, I guess. Anyway, we go in for lunch. Well, the story is so striking. These had right angle turns. Okay, so we go out and we put this plow, it's like a disc plow, that it's a lot of, like an angle, and the weight of it pushes it down and it just turns dirt over, and they had like four discs or something like that. So it totally turned this top layer of soil over a disc plow. And so we got it going along the fence line, got to the first corner, and he would give verbal, you know, the whoa or stop, and he would pull the chain, the reins a little bit. They would walk sideways, and then he would tell them to go forward, and they would get to the next corner. So we did four corners. Now, this is a good story, so I hope you're paying attention. We did four corners, and we're coming back to the first corner that's been plowed. They've been there before. You could have tied your reins off and gone to sleep, and he could have finished the pasture. They stopped where they needed to stop. Now, this is not some idle calculation. They got blinders on, for Pete's sake, to keep them from being disturbed by stuff around them. They stopped. Not only before they hit the fence, they stopped where the plow, when it makes its turn, would be at the right place. In other words, we don't want to be plowing the same rut that we plowed already, or we don't want to skip over 10 feet and start plowing again. We need all of that land tilled. So they did it all themselves because of granddad's strict disciplinarianism. They probably got beat in the head a couple of times learning that.
Yeah.
They stopped just so the plow, which is way behind them, is right where it needs to be to not leave any unplowed land or to overplow.
That's very interesting. How wide was the plow?
Not over 5 or 6 feet at the most.
And how far ahead were they from the plow?
Well, they're just hooked to them. There's a single tree, and then the single tree is hooked onto the plow. So they're, the single tree is just far enough behind the animal so that they won't hit their legs on the single tree. That single tree is the thing that's in turn hooked up to the plow. So there's two single trees and a double tree. I have a double tree out here that I'll show you where you hook two animals to one double tree, and then each of them has a single tree. Matter of fact, the hole can be changed so that it can be used for training an untrained animal, so that the trained animal gets the hard part of the leverage, and the untrained animal doesn't have much to pull. His main job is just to not run off. So that is a training double tree that's out here in my pavilion. So just think about that for a minute. If you had blinders on, I guess they probably could get a glimpse of what was back there. I don't know how they did this, but they would stop where the plow was at just the right place to be in the right place after the 90-degree turn, and they would walk sideways until they were now headed down the old deal. Have I described that? So that you end up with all plowed land, no double plowed and no unplowed. With full attention of the driver, that's not easy. These mules did that by themselves. That's beyond just about. So, I wanted to tell that story, and I guess one final story that will... I love telling stories, and not all of them are self-serving. This one is not self-serving. We were out at the ranch. I was on my horse, Stranger. Buddy had to go somewhere. He was on a little, tiny, really quick and fast, what he called a Spanish pony. And he had to go do something else. I think he did this on purpose, really. But he had to go do something. And he said, "Do not run, Stranger. He's too old. Do not run, Stranger. But I'm going to leave you alone, and you can go on up to where we were going." I think he probably did that on purpose, but it doesn't make any difference. The point is, I disobeyed. As soon as he was out of sight, I said, "Hi-yo, Silver, away!" And we took off as fast as Stranger would go. And in a heartbeat, Buddy was right there on that very fast Spanish pony, grabbing the reins of Stranger right up by the head and yanking it hard and stopping him. And he gave me a real come-to-Jesus meeting right there. But obviously he did got through telling me, "Don't run, Stranger." And I had seen too many cowboys stories. I just couldn't obey. So I'm sorry about that. I've gotten a little better as I got older. But those are most of the horse stories. Well, I guess the final one is they asked me to take all four of these working animals from the farm 16 miles out to the ranch where they needed them. I was probably the summer I worked there. And I couldn't have been more than 14 or 15. I mean, I considered myself the weenie of the group, that's for sure. So they hooked them all four up to a wagon. Or did they? I don't think we even had a wagon. They just hooked them up together, and I rode one of them. They were totally docile. 16 miles along the side of the highway. And I was stunned that they even, asked me to do that. I figured out, now this is real work. This is real work. They don't want to spend a half a day taking those horses out 16 miles to the ranch, but they need them out there. So they let me ride them. They didn't cause any trouble whatsoever. Cars didn't bother. And so I rode those harnessed together, four working animals. And that was, if you've never read the book by James Herriot, and if any of this has been interesting to you, buy them all. James Herriot, he's a North Scottish.
All Creatures Great and Small.
Yeah, well, there's a bunch of those books. If somebody lied and said that he wrote another one that I haven't read, I would buy it. He's a veterinarian that worked mainly big animals up in the Scottish Highlands. That's a great read. If you've enjoyed these stories, you need to buy all of James Herriot's books. Well, I think we're over the limit here. We need to go eat, and I'm impressed that Mitch has sat still for all this. But
I love hearing these stories.
I have enjoyed immensely what we've been...